Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Trump says talks will continue, but the ceasefire is over. How's that work? In so many words, the U.S. is still demanding Iran surrender. Also, exactly what is Washington's position on the Ukraine conflict, and are we witnessing a long-range strike war of attrition? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark here in Moscow. Before we talk about what I mentioned in my introduction, we have the passage of Lindsey Graham in the last few hours. Now, I'm put in a very difficult position because I don't like to speak ill of the dead, but I will speak very ill when he was still alive. Certainly where I am right now, where you are right now, he will not be missed. But he was a figure he's a figure that will be remembered for most of the people watching this program, if not all, not well. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I don't have those compunctions. I don't mind spitting on a corpse. I take a great deal of satisfaction knowing that Lindsey Graham is going to, if there's any such thing as cosmic justice, he will be joining his already departed friend John McCain, his fellow warmongering neocon in whatever depths of hell are reserved for such individuals. And I take comfort in the fact that he died knowing that the U.S. had lost or at least failed to defeat Iran and Russia in Ukraine.
Same question to you, George.
Yes, I agree with Mark. When people die, yes, you're not supposed to speak ill of the dead. However, there are people who are so monstrous, whose influence is so baneful, whose lives have been devoted to such malevolent activities that you can't just simply ignore them. You can't ignore their life's work. And I think John McCain was indeed such a person. And I have to say, when John McCain died, I did indeed say this: the world is a better place for it. When Richard Holbrook died, I said again, the world is a better place for Richard Holbrooke's absence. So I have to say this now, the world is a better place for Lindsey Graham's absence.
Amen.
Amen. Amen. All right, let's keep going, moving on. Mark, while Lindsey Graham was departing us, the United States again started attacking Iran. So this is where we are, I guess. And correct me if I'm wrong. Phase one, shock and awe, kill the supreme leader and the leadership of Iran, and it'll be over. Oh, that didn't happen. Okay, now we have 40 days of an air war. Iran absorbed all of the blows. The U.S. got a lot of bloody noses. We still don't even know the damage in the Gulf to this day. And then we had the MOU, the famous MOU, which Trump didn't seem to take very seriously. And here we are now. So this could be phase four. But why more kinetic action if it didn't work in the first place? I don't get this.
Because they have no better options. And that's what the U.S. does by default. It's as simple as that. The U.S. does not accept Iranian control of the Strait of Hormuz. And they have been attempting over the last few weeks to twist the meaning or their understanding of the Memorandum of Understanding, Article 5, delegates control of the administration of the Strait of Hormuz to Iran and Oman to say, well, Oman without Iran, and we're going to try to peel Oman off from Iran and push ships outside of Iranian coordination through the southern corridor of the Strait of Hormuz. And that's what they were attempting to do for the last 2 weeks. And while the funeral of the former supreme leader, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, by the way, the most, according to no less than the Financial Times, the most attended funeral in all of modern history, although Trump thinks they're fake tears, Iran didn't want to exacerbate the situation. But once the funeral was open and the U.S. keeps pushing ships through the Strait of Hormuz without any coordination with Iran, they reached out and tapped a few of those ships. And the U.S. has responded by kinetic strikes because they have nothing else they can do. They really can't stop Iran from preventing ships from passing through the Strait of Hormuz. And that is what has happened in the last week since this exchange started again, is there has been essentially no traffic again through the Strait of Hormuz, and the global energy markets will soon start to feel the pain again.
You know, George, in looking at what has been reported, the American strikes against Iran over the, I guess it's round three of the tit for tat. It looks like they're trying to disable or Iran's management of the strait. If you look at where of those strikes have been, and without very much success here. Again, you know, this. I'm going to ask the naive question from the back row here. Isn't it to everyone's advantage that it's open, even if it's under Iranian control? I mean, what's really the harm?
Sure, so it helps get this.
Look, it's very hard to understand what the logic here is, because at the same time, what we're trying to do is simply negotiate. This is just simply the 60-day negotiating period before all of the other things go are put in place. So this isn't even about the permanent setup in the Persian Gulf. It's not. This isn't about how the fees or whatever are going to be distributed between Iran, Oman, and the rest of the Persian Gulf. This isn't about any of the other things that are on the agenda, such as the nuclear enrichment of Iran, the issue of the sanctions, the issue of the unfreezing of the assets, all of the things that with the supposedly the negotiating teams are supposed to negotiate. So it's not about any of that. This is just simply about what's going to be in place during this negotiating period. So you have to then think, well, if you can't even agree on that, if you can't even agree on the terms under which the negotiations are going to take place, then how on earth are you going to agree on these much, much bigger, much more complex issues that you're supposed to negotiate? So when Trump says, well, the ceasefire is at an end, but the negotiators are negotiating, then you think, well, what's there to negotiate if the ceasefire is already at an end?
Mark, I'm sure you're going to correct me, my naive question. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's actually a bit more simple and visceral than that. It's about ego, reputation, perception. Yep. Both of Donald Trump as an individual, an egotistical, megalomaniacal president to an unprecedented degree, but also to that of the U.S., and U.S.-led Western global hegemony. The Strait of Hormuz was not actively controlled by Iran prior to the U.S. the Israeli war on Iran a few months ago. Therefore, it is essentially impossible for Trump and the United States to walk away from this whole affair and wash their hands and still claim victory, which is essential to their reputation. Again, both of Trump as an individual and to the U.S. as a hegemon, that they won. In fact, it becomes pretty clear that they took the big L. And so they simply can't accept that. And it is difficult to wrap your head around that you would continue war and economic crisis because of that. But hegemony is something that is largely based on fear and belief. And if that fear and belief are allowed to be openly challenged like that, then it all starts to unravel. So yes, the U.S. frequently does things in foreign policy primarily determined by maintaining their quote-unquote reputation.
Yeah, but George, if the whole goal is, and I don't think the Trump administration, certainly not Israel, takes the MOU seriously at all. Trump signed it because he wants the strait to be open. That's his primary goal. Everything else is a detail at this point here. But by continuing to initiate these tit-for-tat strikes, it keeps it closed. So again, I'm scratching my head. If the goal is to open the strait, they're not opening the strait with their behavior. I get what Mark said, obviously. But as a brass tacks and, you know, global energy markets, you got to take the psychological L, at least at this point.
Hammer, nail.
Yes, it's not opening it. And of course, as Trump did sign on to the ceasefire on April the 8th, and then he did sign on to the Memorandum of Understanding. Well, why did he do that? But he did it because he realized that this is a catastrophe. This war is a total disaster and that he needs to get out of it. Well, now that he's got it, now that he got that Memorandum of Understanding, you know, it is extraordinary that the United States is now obviously trying to cheat on the very first stage. You know, before even any of the talks have begun, already the United States is trying to cheat and try to eliminate Iran completely from the navigation through the Strait of Hormuz. Well, of course, this is a non-starter, and the Iran is saying, this is a non-starter. We're not going to sit back and allow you to essentially try to eliminate our control over the Strait of Hormuz by doing this cute little thing of only allowing shipping through by hugging the Oman coastline. So you're cheating at the very first stage. Well, if you're cheating at the very first stage, then you're not going to accomplish any of the goals that presumably Trump wanted to accomplish when he signed on to the ceasefire and the Memorandum of Understanding.
Yeah, and Mark, I mean, I'm glad that George is bringing up the word cheating, because the U.S. cheated before the 12-day war. It cheated before this war. When I'm making reference to is negotiations, which are supposed to be going on now. So there's a fact pattern here. There's no way you can negotiate with the United States. Is that a fair thing?
And we have the JCPOA, which was signed and secured in a UN Security Council resolution as international law, and Trump ripped it up in his very first term of office. And the same thing with the Minsk agreements. The U.S. was not a party to it, but it certainly did sign on to them again with the UN Security Council resolution. We've said it before. Well, let's say it again. The U.S. is diplomacy incompetent and incapable. You can't do diplomacy with the United States. You have to manage them, but you can't ever trust that anything you agree with them that they will adhere to, because everything is with a finger crossed behind the back, and we'll do what we want anyway as long as we get out of it.
Yeah, that was what Lindsey Graham trafficked in. Just what you exactly said. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. And George, that real news is a question to you. What is the Trump administration's policy on Ukraine now?
It's very hard to know because, of course, in public, at least, in terms of Trump's rhetoric, he tried to distance himself from the Biden policy. So he said, well, we're going to negotiate. You know, this isn't my war. This is Biden's war. I just want to bring this war to an end. We don't have a dog in this fight and so on, even though the policy more or less remained the same, except he got the Europeans to cough up more money than they had been doing under Biden. But what he has now done is to essentially embrace the rhetoric of the Europeans and the rhetoric of NATO, which is that the way to get Putin to the negotiating table is to escalate. The more we escalate, the more we start hitting targets inside Russia, the faster this war will come to an end. This nonsensical notion, for which there's been no evidence whatsoever, and which NATO has repeated, you know, as a mantra of year in, year out, you know, Trump has now embraced. And what is odd about his rhetorical flourish, that it was during this week that NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte had actually said, I have no idea whatsoever as to how to get Putin to the negotiating table. I don't know. I'm not, I don't know what goes on in his mind. Who knows? He doesn't seem to be very keen to negotiate. So all the talk that NATO and all the NATO government heads have been engaging in about, well, the more we do for Ukraine, the more arms we send, the more sanctions we impose, the faster this war comes to an end. Well, Rutte said, I have no idea how to bring this war to an end. And so just at this very moment, Trump seems to have embraced this idea that, well, we just, you know, this is a great idea. Let's try and hit as much Russian hardware as possible.
Mark, did you interpret the Ankara summit as a change of position? Because it was very lukewarm, I thought, the American position. And, you know, the promise of patriots almost to the point of, you know, doesn't even pass the laugh test, okay? Yeah. Though Western media takes it very seriously. You know, I'm aghast by that. Okay, I mean, this the only strategy they have is just more and more gaslighting. Mark.
Yeah, the Western media also took the story of the ghost of Kiev, the Snake Island hoax, and Russians ripping microchips out of washing machines seriously. So that, I mean, that doesn't mean much. The Ankara summit, there's absolutely nothing new except an attempt to double down, right? On escalation, except that there's too many members, you know, whether we're talking Bulgaria or Slovakia or even Italy, that are rocking the boat now, and increasingly, you know, the Dutch are now tapping out for the second time in this conflict and saying we can't give any more, and so forth. I'm so sick of this talking point euphemism that the Western leaders repeat. Bring Putin to the negotiating table, as if Putin ever left the negotiating table. It is the Europeans who refuse to sit down and negotiate with Russia. Now, what they mean is they want Russia to surrender and accept their terms at the negotiating table. And to be fair, Russia is sitting at the negotiating table saying, we'll be glad to talk to you when you accept our terms. Neither side is beaten yet because neither side is willing to accept the other's terms or make substantial compromises. Russia doesn't feel that they have to make any compromises because they believe they're winning, and the West refuses to make any compromises. And Trump has publicly divorced himself from the conflict, yes, and even tried to present himself as some type of neutral third-party mediator, which Russia was willing to play along with for a while, but has given that up. But in reality, he has actually escalated this conflict. He simply farmed it out, the pursuit of it, away from mass new arms package shipments from the Pentagon to the CIA and to private big tech, which is now waging part of the U.S. war on the behalf. The Hornets that are now, over the past month, the Hornet drones that have been hitting Russia's logistics in northern Crimea and Kherson, they're a gift of Eric Schmidt. I mean, they're being provided by, you know, the co-founder of Google. They're big tech and their symbiotic relationship with the U.S. imperial state is,
yeah, and Palantir has got its claws.
And Palantir and Starlink and all of this. These are the weapons that the U.S. is waging this war with, and the CIA is the director of this grand orchestra.
Yeah, but we both agree, all three of us agree, that this is an escalation. But George, let's kind of break that down. We on this program have discussed repeatedly what escalation could look like, and it can get very, very ugly, meaning Russia would end its patience of having this missiles, third-party missiles coming in and killing Russian citizens, meaning the expansion of the conflict, which would, for shorthand, trigger an Article 5. But so what for Trump? I mean, it's a conflict somewhere else, okay? I mean, if the Europeans want to escalate it, well, that's your deal, okay? I mean, that's why I'm kind of downplaying his performance in Ankara and said, like, yeah, well, if it's going to be an escalation, it's going to be an escalation for Europe and Russia, not the United States, so why should he care?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that while the Europeans imagine that they can escalate and they can bluster and that they're safe. They're safe because of Article 5.
Yeah.
How they think Article 5 obliges the United States to go to war on our behalf. I don't think they fully understood exactly what Article 5 says. And I don't think they've ever fully understood the extent to which the United States would keep its distance, and that if there is any escalation and if the war does extend beyond Ukrainian territory, they don't really appreciate that the United States will say, well, okay, well, that's you. That's where, you know, that doesn't mean we are actually going to start lobbing missiles into Russia ourselves. So they don't really realize that how dangerous of the perilous path that they're going on. Because after all, Russia is also watching what has happened during the war against Iran. Iran did not say, well, all these, you know, this is just strictly between the Iran and the United States, is strictly between Iran and Israel. No, it says the neighboring states who have got themselves involved in this, they are legitimate targets. And I think Russia will at some point decide, well, these are legitimate targets because these NATO member states are co-belligerents. I mean, Russia's said this over and over again, co-belligerents, and therefore this escalation will take place. And then I think the Europeans will be surprised how little Article 5 actually offers them.
You know, Mark, also, I mean, again, we all see it in social media, this Ukraine is winning, all this, you know, I mean, it's this massive propaganda wave. It's truly extraordinary. But that is in place of discussing what's going on in the battlefield. And it is looking more and more grim for Ukraine. Take it away.
Yeah. In fact, Zelensky, in his position of speaking from outside the Ankara summit, because he actually wasn't there. He was in an adjacent forum because they didn't want to annoy Trump too much with his presence. But he said, don't pay any attention what's happening on the contact line. That's not important. Pay attention to the drone war that we're waging against Russia. It has totally nothing to do with European drones, right? A long-range strike war of attrition. And the Western media has laid it out with another euphemism. The euphemism they use is, we need to, because they can't win on the contact line, we need to bring the war home to the Russian people. Now, what they're saying is we need to make the Russian civilian population suffer, meaning we need to wage war on the Russian civilian
population. Yeah, but why can't the Russians apply the same logic to Europe?
Well, that's the thing, is they're simply counting that Russia plays by gentlemen's rules of conflict, that they won't resort to the same measures. And ultimately, because of their ideological blinders of exceptionalism, they believe it's justified for them to do it to Russians because they're not really humans deserving of values anyway. I mean, there's nothing wrong with collective punishment of Russians. That doesn't go against our values, right? You know, so Russians are you know, the modern Jews, right? You know, Russophobia is the modern anti-Semitism for the Europeans. It's deeply tied up in their ideology. So they can't even conceive that Russia would enact the same policy against Europeans.
Yeah, well, ask the average Russian. I think that they would feel very differently about that.
They would.
You know, George, as we move forward, is Trump just his, I it doesn't seem to be very solid. I mean, is he just giving the nod to the Europeans? Well, if you can win, it'll be a win for me. But other than that, let's just keep the status quo. You guys are in the driver's seat. Is that how you look at it?
I think so. I think he's now seems to have completely lost interest in.
Well, he spoke about Iran most of the time in anger.
Exactly. He spoke about Iran. I think he's very preoccupied with that. Like he has no idea how to get himself disentangled from that war without looking weak and humiliated. So he really doesn't want to get involved in yet another tussle. He doesn't feel confident enough to challenge the Europeans and put forward any diplomatic initiatives that at least he started doing at the beginning of his second term. So he's more or less saying, go ahead, just keep doing what you're doing. And just don't disturb me with it. But he's got a problem because he's accomplished nothing on this, the war in Ukraine. He's accomplished nothing, obviously, or less than nothing with Iran. And time is going by. And of course, the one thing that hasn't really been noted very much in the media was this recent riot in Lvov in Ukraine, in which the Ukrainians were, protested quite violently over the press ganging of Ukrainians being sent to the front and therefore being sent to their death.
Did you see that? Did you see the hostage film?
Yes. Yes.
Indeed. I mean, those were young boys. I mean, those were young kids. I will imagine there were machine guns behind them.
That's right. So after all the talk about how fantastically well everything is going for Ukraine which again, Trump seemed to sign on to, they're great, morale is high and morale is collapsing in Russia and the Russian economy is in trouble.
So you're going to have to jump in here. And it seems to me we're only arguing with Western propaganda here and not with reality. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, cross talk rules.